Okay. And as of this moment, I'm also recording the audio. And I'll take that and I will put that on the wiki and the slides will be there. So if you want to, you know, go back and look over any of this material, you have access to it. And if you want to share it with a colleague that's not here, you can do that too, et cetera. So before I kind of go into my spiel, I want to start by setting the stage and ask you to watch this. How do you know what they know? What do you think is the answer in the video to that question?
Their performance?
Their performance.
The product.
The product, right? What they do. They gave us a number of examples, right? So we've got the kids singing in the choir, and then you've got the kids, you've got people swimming, you've got a kid on the ropes course. You've got kids learning how to swim. There's even the boy that with his skateboard. And there's no question he's learned that, right? And been persistent in trying to figure it out. And it just seems clear, like so we do a really good job for kids in the performing arts in our schools. Kids who sports teams, right? Choir, drama, they have these stages, and it's like when you see those kids perform, there's no question that they've learned something and learned it really well. The problem for me, and particularly as a math teacher, okay, I come from a mathematics background, the problem I have with that because I think the answer to the question, and I'm not suggesting that that's all we do is give tests. We have to come up with that number, and there's that pressure on us to do things that create numbers that we can aggregate. But how do we actually know what kids know? Well, we do a really good job in sports and in the performing arts of creating stages where kids show off what they've learned. They tell us what they know. As a math teacher, and I think any other content area teacher, the problem is, where's the academic stages? Like, what if your kid is really good at math, and they don't happen to be a jock? They don't happen to be in the choir? Shouldn't there be a stage somewhere where they get to show off what they know? Usually the first pushback I get is, well, there's math contests, right? There's the science fair. Does that happen once a year? Is that what we do to our sports teams? Is that what we do to our choir? They get one shot a year and they're done? Or do they know our choirs, our sports teams? Do they know the dance class? Do they know that they're going to be on stage again and again and again. And because of that, they make sure that the stuff that they show is the very best it can be. So where is the stage, where's the academic stage? Where is the stage where kids can show off how much they dig science? How much they enjoy crafting an awesome story? Where is the stages for those kids? And that's hopefully what I hope to answer by the time we get to the end of this session. Have any of you seen this book, How People Learn? Okay. For me, this book is absolutely seminal, revolutionized the way I teach. Okay? And it's free. And when you go to the website and you click on our, you find our session and you get to this slide, you just click on the book and it'll take you to the website where you can read it for free online, or you can, if you want to buy it and download it as a PDF, you can do that too. So what they did is they went and they looked at years and years of research. It's not one study, it's a study of studies. And they went back and they looked at what do all these studies say, what are the commonalities about how all people learn. And as an outgrowth of that book, they wrote another one called How Students Learn, also free and available online. How Students Learn History, Mathematics, and Science. They said, like, how do kids actually go about the business of learning this stuff? Because if we're just going to teach them, then shouldn't we know something about that? So what I want to do is I want to pull out, I'm going to talk about three practices and three principles. So the three principles we're going to start with, about come out of this book, the three fundamental principles about how people learn. I think actually there's a fourth one in there, but I won't go into it in this session. And let me start with practices that link to the principle. This is one of the practices that I put up, or I try to weave into the way I design learning experiences for my students. Like, what's going on right now in this room, I have no idea what's going on behind your eyes. I have no access to, like, am I reaching you? Is anything I'm saying resonating with you? Am I wasting your time? Or are you counting down the minutes so you can get out of here and get to lunch? Like, there's no way for me to know that. And there's no way for me to know that in a class when I have a bunch of students there that are trying to teach the quadratic formula to. So there's got to be some way for me to access their thought. I'm always about making kids thinking transparent and visible. So I try to create these galleries of student thought. And the three practices I'm going to talk about, you can't really pull them apart and say they're entirely separate. They do overlap and intermingle. But I want to find ways that I can give students opportunities to make their thinking transparent so that I can see it. But not just the students' thinking, I want the students to see my thinking. As an expert, I talked about this a little bit in the keynote. Like, I want them to see, like, how do I wrestle with a problem, and let that be a model for them. Although that doesn't really do them justice, because they're not experts. It's not realistic to expect them to approach problems like an expert, although they should be exposed to that kind of thinking. What's perhaps more valuable to my students is to make their thoughts transparent to each other. To see how a novice deals with acquiring this new information, this new knowledge, and working with it. To see how a novice makes mistakes and then fixes it. And to learn to figure out, to answer the question, like, how do I know if I'm right or not? And I teach math. And the question most often heard in math classes is, so am I right? And my answer almost universally is, are you? How would you find that out? So that's first practice, and it's related to this first principle. This principle comes out of the book. That before we teach, whatever content we teach, we first have to look at what are the students' preconceptions that they bring to the table with them. They did a study and they about kids' views of the world before studying science. And when they come into science class, they're told that the world is round, it's a sphere, it's a ball floating in space. Well, that doesn't jive with your reality of the way you experience the world around you when you're a little kid. I mean, it doesn't jive with your experience as an adult either. Like, do you guys see the curve? Right? Do you see that we're standing on a ball? Or is that just a mental construct? So, anyways, after the kids were told that, okay, so the world is a sphere, it's a ball, in their mind, when they asked them questions and had conversations with them, the kids understood now that, yes, the world's not flat, it's a pancake. It has a little bit of thickness to it. And understanding that the kids bring that misconception to the table informs our instruction. So it doesn't matter what you're teaching, you gotta think about what are the preconceptions that the kids arrive in class with. So this image, when we teach them mathematics, we teach them multiplication, and often we teach it as repeated addition. That's kind of how we first introduce them to repeated addition. I remember my son coming home from school one day and saying, "Dad, what's a decimal?" So my answer to him was this: "Well, that's how we write a number that's smaller than one." What do you think of that as an answer?
It's really accurate.
Accurate. But it's also imprecise. Because a decimal, well, it can be numbers bigger than one, right? You can have like 1.2, that's a decimal, bigger than one. Then you can have funky decimals, right? You have like 0.333, repeating decimals, they never end. You can have terminating decimals. You can have transcendental numbers like pi, infinite decimals that never repeat. Like, this is a can of worms, what's a decimal? Right? But when he first asked me, what's a decimal, that's how we write a number smaller than one. And when that's accommodated, then we're ready to move to the next phase and explore in more depth what a decimal is. So we often teach multiplication as repeated addition, but that's just telling kids, well, it's a way to write a number smaller than one. Because multiplication actually becomes more than that. It becomes, it's a relationship of ratios between things. It's about proportionality, really. And so because they think of it as repeated addition, and early on they learn that the answer you get, whatever it is, better be bigger than either of the numbers you started off with. So if they're going to multiply this, a kid looks at that and they kind of say, they don't see it even, they ignore it. And they just say, well, I need to have a number bigger than either of the ones I started off with. And if we know that when we're teaching them, we know that they're coming with this preconception, then that informs our instruction. If you don't address the preconceptions, then what you have is kids doing mistakes and you're like, why did you do that? Like, what were you thinking? And they're having trouble articulating it. Until you have that conversation that reveals, you teach me, how do we do that problem? So you can see what the problem is. Second practice is publish it. Publish everything. Everything the kids do. And I talked about this a little bit in the keynote this morning, so I won't show it again, unless you really want to see it. But, you know, like what happened with that grade 5 class, what I didn't tell you in the keynote, okay, is that ever since that happened with this group of kids and Stevie Nicks, they've gone viral. They have more hits on their blog than like thousands and thousands of hits. They have now sung with, like, I think it must be dozens of different big name performers. These are the grade 5 kids, with dozens of big name performers, and big name performers leave messages for them on their blog saying, I want to sing with you. Yeah.
So my question to that is that we have to get a waiver form from every single parent to even show their face.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you go about that for every single class and every...
Yeah. So, okay. That's a really good question. So, first off, like I was talking this morning, everything happens in a context. And every context is different, and it's different from classroom to classroom. It can be different from school to school, division to division, and every division kind of deals with this a little bit differently. Some divisions allow that kind of stuff, and they include it in their ways. Some divisions, no, that's not part of our, a lot of divisions have these things called acceptable use policies. The real unfortunate phrase should probably be called, we shouldn't be teaching kids about acceptable use policies very top down, instead teaching them responsible use policies, which they own the issue, they have to act responsibly. But you have a conversation with your administration, you have a conversation with teachers in your building, and say like, okay, so what do we need to do? Like in my classes, you won't ever see pictures of my kids' faces. So we can take pictures of kids as long as, in my division, we can take pictures of kids, but we can't have a name linked to the picture, or we can have a name, but we can't have a picture. So what I do is we use first names only or aliases that the kids create, as long as I know who's who, and they never put pictures of their faces.
So that's what I'm saying, a video like this that you say has brought these kids all this wonderful stuff. If one parent of any one of those kids said their child could, that video couldn't have happened.
Yeah.
And I can tell you right now that if there's always, in a class of 30 kids, there's always somebody that says absolutely not.
Yeah. So if that's the context, so two comments about that. There's a, so I have a colleague, her name is Kathy Cassidy, she teaches grade one in Saskatchewan, Moose Jaw. And what Kathy does is she sends home a letter at the beginning of every year. She says, if you don't, you know, if you're not granting permission for your child's image and voice and all the rest, that's fine. Just indicate that on the form. And that's okay. And then she starts collecting pictures of the kids at work and kids doing interesting stuff and they're publishing content and they're doing video, whatever. But those kids, their images are never put. She's respecting the rights of their parents. 3 weeks into the course, every single year, once they start seeing and it starts talking in the community, look what, you know, my son did, look what my daughter did, those parents say, can I change that? Yeah, if you flood the internet with the good stuff you're doing, people want to see more good stuff.
So do you think that'll eventually change where we will have acceptable or responsible agreements because they're in a public setting and somebody who doesn't want to have their kid out there would have to say, please don't?
Well, I think every parent has the right to say, no, I don't want you to put my child's image here. Like, and that's totally okay. As I think there's also kind of a social pressure builds that, well, I can see everybody else's kid doing really good stuff, I want to see my kid too. Some parents may decide that that's not for them. I mean, you know, it's like this. So a number of years ago, I've got a colleague, his name is Dave Cormier. He works Prince Edward Island, okay? And when his son was born, his son's name is Oscar. When Oscar was born, he started publishing all these pictures of Oscar on Flickr. And then would share on Twitter, like, some new pictures of Oscar, whatever. And so I'd go and I'd look, and cute little kid, right? And I was a dad too, and I had young kids too, a little older than Oscar. And then I kind of had a conversation with Dave. I said, Dave, how did you and your wife come to the decision that you were going to put pictures of Oscar online? Like, how did you do that? And his answer to me was, he said, well, it's going to happen eventually anyways. Like, one way or another, there's going to be some picture of him somewhere. So I'd rather flood the internet with the stuff that I choose to put rather than let someone else decide what's going to be seen, in the same way that I was talking about earlier today. So what is the future in Manitoba? What's going to happen? Well, I don't know. I mean, I can't answer that question. I can prognosticate with the best of them. One thing I can tell you about all those prognostications is they're going to be wrong, because what's going to happen in the end is as we evolve our practice and as we work collectively to do good things and to share that positive stuff, together we'll figure out how to do this properly. But we need to have this conversation. You need to have that conversation with the parents of the students in your class. And some of them will say yes, and some of them will say no, and you respect that. And if they all say no, like in that choir, well, that doesn't prevent you from podcasting. It's just their voices.
Right, like, the parents say no to video, but be fine with audio and schoolwork.
Okay, so there you go. And you see, and that's fine. Like, you respect the wishes of the parents. And that, you know what? It's almost a good thing. But it's not almost, it is. It's a really good thing when you have a parent say no, not, and everybody sees that you respect those wishes, right? That everybody's being honored and is receiving the respect that's their due. Anyway, so anyway, interesting story with those kids. So the second principle that comes out of the book is that learning is networked. And it's not just like, for example, the example I often give is like, when I say to you 3/4, what does that mean? Okay, fraction. Does anyone think of something different?
Of what?
3/4. When I say 3/4, what does that mean to you?
No,
of what? Like
what?
3/4 of, like you need to have something to get 3/4 of. Very good.
75 cents.
75 cents. Right? Like
football game.
A football game.
Almost there.
Almost there. Right? 0.75. Right? The idea of 3/4 doesn't live in isolation. It's connected to the physical coins that we call quarters. It's connected to money. It's connected to a football game. It's connected to the notion of being almost there, doing pretty good. It's a number. It's a fraction. It's a decimal. You see, the notion 3/4 is not a simple idea. It lives at the center of a network of understandings, which as adults, we don't have problems with it. Like, we shift easily from each representation of 3/4
without pause, because what we understand is, like what you said, 3/4 of what? Right? The question is the context. Like when I say to you, orange, what am I talking about? Some of you will guess the fruit and some of you will guess the color. Whichever you guess, I'll say the opposite. Right? Because now if I say, I ate an orange for breakfast, well now from the context you know what's going on. Because that orange, again, lives within a network. By itself it's ambiguous, but once you've placed it in its context of networked understandings, then it takes on a new meaning. So when we, and all of knowledge is like this. We've learned in the past, growing up, when we went to school, that everything was arranged hierarchically, but that, in fact, is not the case. Like, if you start to read, say you read an article in Wikipedia, right? Well, every article in Wikipedia has got links to other articles in Wikipedia. If you go read Britannica, it's kind of locked in a place. With paper, topics have to end. And if you want a justification for why this is included in this discussion, there's a footnote. How many of you then went and looked at the source cited in the footnote and then went to the library to get the book off the shelf that it was, and to find that page? Oh, yeah, he did say that. Often, if you actually go through that whole process, by the time you get to the library and try to find the book off the shelf, it's someone else took it out. But what if the footnote is a hyperlink? What stops you from clicking? Like, have you ever not clicked the hyperlink about something you were interested in? See, digital invites a depth of understanding. Digital invites exploration. Digital invites lifelong learning. Paper says things fit in boxes and it ends here. It doesn't. Anyways, all learning is networked. The way we understand things, they live in networks. Every concept, every idea you teach lives in some network. You need to understand that network. But more than that, it's like I said this morning, when you've got a hard problem to solve, but you just sit in the corner and think hard? No, you talk to people. And if it's a real problem that you can't figure out in yourself, you really kind of lean on colleagues, friends, other people that you meet. You seek them out and build social networks. And that was part of what the video I showed this morning when that math teacher from Alaska was talking, right? That they're learning that in order for them to understand the concepts, a big part of that is the network that the kids live in the classroom, where they depend and lean on each other to help them learn. And this is the third practice. Kids create stuff. Everything that kid. A lot of your instructional design should be centered around the stuff that kids make, so that they can show it off and you can share it. So when we think about pedagogy, you've all seen this before, right? Bloom's taxonomy. And so in 2000 it was updated. It used to be that at the very top they had, it was evaluate, then synthesize, then analyze, apply, understand, remember. In 2000, it was updated. They throw out synthesize, and they say create is at the top and move out and evaluate down. You see, because we don't want kids operating at this low-level thinking. Generally, that's thought as kind of low-level understandings, low-level thought. Higher-order thinking happens when kids create. When kids have to create something, when kids create content that educates someone about what they've learned, then that requires that they evaluate the material that they've learned, they analyze, apply, understand, remember, they get into all of it. And I've never liked the way that triangle was drawn. I draw it like this. Because that's where the emphasis should be. So this ties in also to the third principle, which comes out of the book. And the third principle in the book is that learning is facilitated through the use of metacognitive strategies. And that whatever you're teaching, however, as part of the learning design that you do in your classroom, there's got to be a component in there somewhere, somehow, not forced, it's got to be authentic, or the kids won't do it, where kids start thinking about what they're learning as they're learning it. There's got to be some metacognitive component to what you're doing. So let me show you through a series of examples how those three principles and the three practices that I talked about all kind of come together. Okay? So for example, this is an assignment that we've done in education for years and years, the creation of mind maps, to understand like what a kid knows. And what I like about this is it kind of gets at that network of understanding. where the kid has an opportunity to show what they know. These are actually two pretty good ones. This one is about biology, and that one is about running. And then you might even take that and put it on the wall, so I guess that's kind of publishing, but that's not quite what I'm getting at. So when I started thinking about mind maps, and I was trying to think about, okay, so what would a mind map look like if it was digital, and I want to publish it, and I want to create these galleries of kids' thought, because the key is not just having one kid publish what they do, it's having them all. So the assignment was, I was teaching math, it's a grade 11 class, and the assignment was, I want you to go out in the world with your cell phone, I want you to capture a picture, a real world picture, that you took yourself. In this case, they were studying quadratic functions. So quadratics, the graphs look like U-shaped graphs. And I want you to take that picture and then upload it to Flickr. And on Flickr, Flickr's got a special functionality built into it where you can put these little hotspots, notes, on top of the image in Flickr. And so I'll make that larger. And so when you move your mouse over it, all these hotspots become active, and she's filled in. So like at this point, we have the vertex. And she gives, you know, the algebra related to that in the description. She explains what a quadratic function is. Over here, she's got a root. Over here, she explains what the x-axis is. Because the parabola is looking downwards, we know something about this. So everything that she learned in the unit on quadratics is encapsulated in this one image, and it shows her understanding of what she learned in that unit. By the way, I told you, my students are not allowed to take pictures that include their faces. Look how she dealt with that. I've always been very proud of that, right? Because she got creative with it. Now, when I publish this stuff online, and I have kids publish their things on Flickr, so I have them include tags. And the tag that I had them include, and this you have to think deeply about, when you work digital with your kids, you're going to want a tag for your class that picks out your class uniquely and the world, right? Picks out your class uniquely and identifies the work produced as coming from your class. I'll show you what I mean. Like in this case, the screen isn't great, but I don't know if you can you see the tags over here? Okay, so it's very, very hard to see that. Is that a little better?
Yeah, that's
better. Okay. So, okay, she tagged it quadratic because I called, that was the assignment tag. And then, so PC30SF06. I'm pretty sure people aren't tagging to remember things with that. Okay? But to me and my students, it's meaningful. You see, because this girl, she took pre-calculus 30S with me in the fall semester of 06. And what I like about this tag is it's scalable, because when I teach pre-cal 30S, in the winter semester of 07, and it just becomes W07. So you gotta think deeply about what you want your tag to be. It's gonna pick out your kids, so it could be like maybe your initials, the year. Think about it. But you need a course tag. Now why a course tag? Because when I click on the tag, and this is how kids hand in work to me, right? So I'm not carrying a lot. You understand, I'm not doing less work than I did when we were using paper. I'm doing different work. So now this is all her stuff that's tagged with pieces. So this is all her assignments for that class. So if I want to see just hers, then I can click on all public content. And it's only my students that are using that tag. So this is what that class produced. And this is kind of important because when kids share what they're learning, I don't want just the one kid to publish their work. I want to create these galleries of thought. I want them to see how each other are thinking about things. So this is what another student did, and this is for a different unit. This was on circle geometry. This is for a different assignment, and this is actually something that was on my wall. This is this kid, in this case, actually links out, does a search on the internet for more information related to this topic, and includes that link when he does his description of what he's learned. So that's what I thought of with digital mind maps. They publish their content, they share their content, they begin to see how everything is connected and related one to the other. And it also reveals kind of the misunderstandings, right? They're
Like, if a kid has a preconception that's interfering with what they understand, it's going to be very evident when you see that.
For the other thing I think is so important there, Darren, is that the next year's class can look at the previous and leverage and build upon it and go, like, it keeps building as opposed to, as you say, on the paper and no one else sees it.
Yeah. And you know what? So every time I do one of these things, right, you try something, you might fall flat on your face, and it's important that kids see you do that and how you deal with that. But what I do at the end of every one of these is that we have a conversation. Sometimes we even podcast that conversation to preserve it. Because, I mean, if they listen to it, great, but usually it's for me. Like, I'll publish it on the blog, but I want to go back and listen to it as I'm planning the next year. So when we talked about this, one of the complaints the kids made was, all the good pictures are going to get taken. I thought, you know, okay, so they, you know, this is what they did for quadratic, so what are we going to do? Because all, and that turned out to be a red herring, because every kid has to take their own picture, right, of their experience of their own lives, which is interesting, because they've taken something like quadratics and the quadratic formula, and it's now personalized to that kid. The students that kind of really engaged with the assignment tell me that they remember this stuff when it comes time to write exams and stuff like that. So the solution manual is familiar to teachers of science and mathematics. Solution manual is usually, it's a book that has the answer to every question in the textbook, and not just the answer, but step-by-step solutions, and kids can reference it or not. Now, my experience is they very rarely reference solution manuals, and now I'm starting to think, okay, I want kids to create the content, right? I want to create galleries of thoughts. I want kids creating content that educates others about what they've learned, and I want to do this in some network way. So what am I going to do? What's that going to be, a solution manual? So in this case, what I had them do is we made a wiki. And I'll pick, so every one of those things is another wiki, okay, from a different class. So if I click on that one, so that is my AP Calculus class from 2008. I've done this with grade 10, 11, 12, all seniors classes. And so what I did was, the assignment takes 2 weeks. What I do is I take exam level questions and I seed them in the wiki. So every page is like one question, and I just copied the question. And so week one for the kids is they create the solutions manual. I mean, in this session, I'm not talking about blogging, but, you know, the daily practice of my class is my kids don't read textbooks right? And I don't expect them to. I expect them to write the textbook. My students write the textbook, one student a day, every day. They write what they learn in class that day, summarize it well enough for an interested learner to learn from them, choose who will be the author for next day's page, and the cycle continues, and that's what it looks like on the blog. That's like a really condensed explanation of something that takes maybe a day to develop. So this is the solution manual for the textbook that they're creating, right? And so every, you know, one page has got a question. In week one, the kids have to go in and pick a question, any question they want, solve the question, publish that on the wiki, and then annotate the solution. They've got to write how they did it, how they did what they did, why they did what they did, well enough for an interested learner to learn from them. That's week one. Now, I give them a whole week to do this. If you stop to think about this, each kid is asked to solve one question. I mean, realistically, that's an overnight homework assignment, right? And that's not even the whole of the homework assignment. Realistically, you could give them more. I give them a week. I want it to be low pressure. I want to see the very best work they've got. And then comes week two. Week two of the assignment, so week one is called the significant contribution. The significant contribution means that the kid goes in and they make a full detailed solution of the problem. Week two is a constructive modification. A constructive modification means you go back to the wiki and you look at this other student's work, not your own. See, kids thought week one was tough because they had to solve a question and annotate it. In my head, it's week two. Week two is tough because they go back to the wiki and they have to look at their classmates' work and they have to edit someone's work, not their own, find an error that they've made and correct it. Or if they inadequately explain something, make it better. Make a constructive modification to the solutions manual. Or maybe you're going to reconfigure the way the whole wiki works. Like, maybe you're going to put in a system to quickly access things on the wiki. Whatever, you get creative with it. Have fun with it. But that's the constructive modification. So, okay, so if we look at, like, this is one of the questions that one of the kids did. So this was a bit of a smaller class. And they have access to the grading rubric right off the hop, and there's an equation editor that shows them how they can type math online, and so on and so forth. It's loading really slow. But it'll get there. Anyways, when we get there, what you'll see is you'll see at the top of the page, we've got the original question that I asked, and then you'll see this whole long detailed solution, which I'm really hoping is going to load sooner than later. Almost there.
PB works?
Yeah.
It has load issues lately.
Oh, really?
This whole year at my school, because I have teachers on PB works, depending on the network, like we've been experiencing all sorts of fluctuations. We've been working with Merlin on it.
No solution yet?
Well, they did actually a patch on our router.
Yeah. Did that fix it?
Firmware up. It seemed to, for our teachers getting on, so.
Well, anyways, it's taking a long time to load, so.
That could be a router.
It could be a router? Rats. Anyways, how many people have used wikis before? Okay, so I'll go through this really quick. So once you see the problem, you'll see the solution, and it's kind of like we go into the history, and we can see who did what and when. And so the original set of problems you'll see is solved by, you'll see a bunch of edits by me when I created the problem. Then you'll see a series of edits made by one of the students. That's the student solving the problem and annotating, etc. And then you'll see a student come in and edit. And it gets edited by several different students over time. And you can kind of see exactly what the student did, because you can compare. There's two little buttons. You click this button here and this button there, and you can compare those two edits. And it shows you in red and green. Green is what's been added, red's what was deleted. And with luck, we'll get a chance to see it.
Is this with the free wiki, or are you...
This is all free.
It's all the free.
Yeah, everything I'm showing you is free. Everything I show you costs nothing. So there's the question. There's kind of a quick find code to quickly jump down to part A, B, or C. The student is using color in a meaningful way. They've embedded all kinds of equations. There's a graph, and so on and so forth. There's this diagram. Blue is the lower function inside, red is upper function outside. Remember that picture? We come back to it in a minute, and so on and so forth. And it just goes on and on and on and on and on. So the question, of course, is who did this? Whose work is this? So if we look at the history to that, it will show us which kid did what. And since I'm going to be running out of time, there's more stuff I wanted to show you, and it's not loading quick, I'll just tell you that picture was edited. The original student had that picture wrong. It was not red and blue, it was both red, and instead of pointing at two different circles, they were both pointing at one circle. And when we go and look at the edits that other kids made, some kid made a whole lot of edits, but not a significant change to the problem. Then there's one kid that makes one edit. You look at it and kind of, one edit? Like, what did you do? But then you go look at actually what the edit is, you click on the page as that kid edited it, and you see he's changed the picture. That's a significant contribution. He's found an error, and he's corrected it, and he's done it in a really positive way. So the wiki solution manuals got at those three ideas, right? Creating galleries of the kids' thought, they can see each other's stuff. It incorporates that metacognitive element, because they have to correct other kids' work. So they've got to think about how that was done in a real authentic way. The hardest thing about the wiki assignment, hardest thing, is practicing silence. Like week one, don't say anything. Let them make the mistakes without your commenting at all. Just be quiet. Because you need to leave that there so that week two can happen. And week two is the real juice. Okay, so poster projects. Poster projects are neat because they go up on walls. It's a little bit of network, a little bit of community, a little bit of publishing. But then I started thinking, so what can we do differently as a poster project? Well, this was one that my son was given. So he's in grade 7, and he's taking ELA, and they're reading this book, Underground to Canada. So then they get this assignment. And the assignment says, well, you have to create a map. The book is about June, Lily, and Liza, and they escaped slavery in the United States, and they through the Underground Railroad, circuitously, they find a way to Canada, being slaves. So they had to create a map articulating this journey. They had to do it, you know, on a poster, because it's going to get published somewhere, and it was being assessed on relevance to the novel 10 marks, creativity 15 marks, and accurate labeling of locations on the route 5 marks. So I was worried about this Creativity 15 Mark C, because my son isn't, he doesn't dig art. And it's not, it's just not his thing. He's good at other stuff, but that's not his thing. And that's half of mine. So I was like kind of worried. And then he kind of shows me the book, and then in the front of the book there's this. And it says what each of these points are. And I said, so what exactly is the assignment? Like, what do you have to do? And then I'm starting to like, underground railroad and slavery, these are important issues. Like, it's important that kids understand stuff like that. I wanted him to do that in a little more depth. So he went and he asked the teacher, can I do it digitally? And would that be okay? Teacher, very amenable. And so he created a Google map. And on the Google map, so he creates his own Google map. And on the map, he puts a pin everywhere for the locations. But it's, he got angry with me. Because he, I said, you know, so here's what we'll do with pins, and we'll have pictures from Flickr, and you'll get videos from YouTube. And he got ticked off at me because I wouldn't let him just make the map. I said, okay, first, I want you to write a summary of what happened in each of those locations. And from point one to point two, their journey, just two or three sentences about what happened. So he pulls up a Word document and says, okay, Dad, now map? I said, no. Now you go to Flickr, and I want you to find pictures of those places. And I taught him about how to search in the Creative Commons archive so that he's respecting copyright. And so he goes and he starts collecting all these pictures, and he's dropping them in a Google notebook. And then he says, okay, now the map? And I said, no. Now you got to go to YouTube and start looking for the Underground Railroad and start finding the videos. I can't tell you how many hours of video he watched about the Underground Railroad in Canada, in the United States, and how those people ended up from the United States and Canada. How many pictures he saw when he actually saw, this is what that place looked like. He has a picture there of a slave auction block, what it looked like. It's a little chunk of wood from a tree. He's got a picture of the proclamation of the Emancipation Proclamation. Like, he's got some awesome stuff. So then I started, so now is he actually learning, you know, good stuff? This also isn't loading very quickly, or I'd show you, maybe it'll come. Anyways, when you click on the pin, so then he says, after the YouTube thing, he says, okay, Dad, now, map? Yeah, now, map. So he edits the map, drops a pin, in the description of the pin, he copies out of the Word document, pastes in the text that he'd written early, goes and grabs the picture off Flickr that he's already saved and pastes that in. Then you can't embed YouTube videos yet in Google Maps, so he links to the videos out on YouTube, and there's a whole narrative of what happens to these two kids. And that was his poster project, using Google Maps. And now, he did this in grade 7, he's towards the end of grade 8 now. So it's like I was saying earlier this morning, like, where are the other kids' posters? Would you like to see them? Because they're probably cool. Like, some of the kids did awesome stuff. I wonder where that stuff is now. Like, if it was your kid, and they did this in grade 7 as a project in the middle of the school year, where is it? But my son's stuff, like, that's going to stay there forever. There's no reason for that to be deleted. It doesn't cost anything. Unfortunately, I can't get it. But again, all the links in the slides, you can come back and explore. He did this neat thing at the end. You kind of click on the pin, and it says, don't click here until you've read everything else. And then scroll down. So you scroll down and it says, no, really, don't. Get out of here quick and come back when you see that. You scroll down some more and it says click here. And so you click the link and he created a proto page. So all the pictures that he didn't use, all the videos that he didn't use, he didn't want to throw them out. So he aggregated them on pages on the proto page and saved them there. So yeah, here it is. So it finally is loaded. So there's a photo that's supposed to load there, but again, it's still slow. So this is his description. There's a photo that's embedded there, and he links to the video, etc. And then here's that thing that he did with the proto page. He says, no, really, read everything else on the page, scroll down. No, really, only if you've read everything else, scroll down. And by the time you get to the bottom here, it just says, click here. And I don't know if that's going to load. Maybe that's quicker. In the interest of time, I'm going to press on. Presenting project works, having kids do presentations in class. I think that's great. When kids have to articulate what they've learned to other people, I think that's fantastic. So the assignment I gave my kids was, okay, I want you, now this is a math class, so my thinking was, again, getting at the notion of having create content that educates. and I teach math, so I'm saying, okay, what are they going to create in math? Well, my feeling is this. If a kid takes a course, like a history course, then at the end of that course, they should have some idea of what historians do. Right? If they take a literature course, they should have some idea of what it is that authors do or what critical analysis is. If they take a math course, they should have some idea of what mathematicians do. Now, from an entirely different presentation, one of the myths that people have about mathematics is they think mathematics is computation. Mathematics has nothing to do with computation. It's like, you know, knowing your multiplication tables is to mathematics, and what the alphabet is to ELA. Like, so what do mathematicians actually do? They don't just sit and figure all day. They create mathematics. So if my kids should leave my math class knowing something about what the mathematicians do and fitting in with the rest of the paradigm I've described, then I want them to create mathematics. So that's what they did. They had to create four problems that cover a minimum of 2 units of work. They start this at the very beginning of the semester. We do it in stages. So the first stage is find 3 problems that you're going to copy, not create. Right? And there'll be models that you'll build on, and then later the final project has to be problems that they create, not copy. It has to be original work. Okay? And then they solve the problems, they annotate the solution, and publish it online any old way you like. I don't care how. Do it any old way you like. So I didn't do it here. Okay, I'm not going to go online to show you this stuff because I have it aggregated elsewhere. Because things aren't loading, why not do that? That's just quickly up.
Oh, cool.
For this. I would not have done this if the videos were actually, if we were able to link the stuff to it. Anyways, so what the kids did is they had to publish. So what some kids did was they went in Halo, the video game. So Halo's got like this video component of it, and they created characters and acted out these scenes where these characters are running around in Halo, and then they get into trouble, which means the only way to solve it is by solving this math problem, and then they solve this math problem, so they had a video of that, and then on the blog they've got the detailed solution of all that, and then it's told in a story arc, right? And then the... So that's what these kids did. Mathematics is the science of patterns. It's something like MITSOP is how they said that. And so one student would have to do 4, 2 students working together would do 5, and 3 students would do 6. I'm encouraging them to work together. I want them to do that. And then they ended up creating, like, it was like a poster, and then they had like a teaser release. There was a video, and because the net's not working, I can't show you the teaser, which was really cool. And the whole thing ends in a cliffhanger, because these kids were in my pre-calculus class, and they knew they were coming back to me the following year to take AP, and they say, come tune in next year. And then, I really wanted to show you one of them. There's one of them. So this is when they came back next year, this is what they did. This is the teaser for the follow-up. It's just about a minute long. Calculus Islands.
That's good.
So, and they, and so like this wasn't part of the assignment, but that's something that they did on their own. Like this one, this student is, his entire project is just this video.
I lived a great life, but it hadn't always been that way. There was a girl back home, Lynn. She could steal the sun out of the sky. I almost proposed, but I heard it said that when fate comes knocking, it's too late to board your windows. Cue the draft, and I thought I'd never see her again. There was the younger guy in my squadron, Mikey. He was all right. He thought he was a mathematician. I reckon he was right. Most days he buzzed in and told me, I don't know, how unlucky I was being born when I was born, how I was statistically more likely to be drafted, like it mattered then. Some days he'd have interest in war math. He got his info from some mole on the other side. Turns out the opposing army received one new squadron of 50 soldiers every 5 weeks, and each soldier received one rifle and 100 rounds on the first day, and for every tomorrow, they received 90% of what they received.
And now you're into a geometric sequences problem.
On day
maybe
one.
Without realizing it. And he does his whole project is this video, and then he takes the text, right, the script, and he puts that all on a blog, and that's all published elsewhere, and it's linked to one blog that's on the This one is another one where kids did the entire thing in as YouTube, a series of YouTube videos. So I don't know if there's any sports fans out there who like baseball. This is the Barry Bonds question.
Barry Bonds steps up to the plate at Fenway Park in the bottom of the ninth with the bases loaded and down 3 points to the Boston Red Sox. Just as the ball makes contact with Bonds' bat, 71 meters above him, a bird is flying with a velocity of -19. Bonds hits the game-winning grand slam, and the crowd goes nuts, but the bird is not so happy as the ball heads straight for him. What is the bird's instantaneous acceleration when the ball hits the bird? The first step of the solution is to anti-differentiate the
ball. So that's kind of neat, the way they show the music comes in. They're just talking math. And they just go, I won't go through the whole thing. And so that's, they did it in really creative ways. And I said, like, I developed the rubric with the kids. Like I said, so what should we be assessed on and what counts and how shall we weight different things? And, you know, we can have that conversation another time too. And then, and the kids, we decided that creativity should be part of it, but it shouldn't be a required part. So they put creativity as a bonus. You could get up to 105%. These projects count in my classes for 20% of their class mark. And they and so they have to cover, of course, a minimum of 20% of the curriculum. Because of the depth of the problems that the kids end up pursuing, they do way more than 20% of the curriculum. Like, and in terms of, like, how do I know what they know? Well, don't you know what they know? Like, it's easy to tell. Okay. So, now it's over to you. You know, what should you do? Well, wade through galleries of the students' thoughts. Make that visible somehow, and good things happen when you publish their work. And you remember what 1620 was? Well, you'll know what they know when they create content that educates.
Now, all the tools and stuff that I've talked about here, if you're not familiar with that, there's the other sessions here today, but how many of you have heard of the K-12 Online Conference? Okay, so I'm one of the original conveners, all volunteers from all over the world, people just sharing what they know in the classroom, how to use different tools, how to overcome the obstacles that we find, different challenges that we face. What about leaders? What about, you know, teacher leaders, principals, superintendents, and those sort of folks? There's stuff for everybody there. So k12onlineconference.org, and that's it. Have a good lunch.